From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross.
The study of sex is the study of the beginning of all life. And science holds the key.
In the Showtime series Masters of Sex, Michael Sheen plays groundbreaking sex researcher William Masters. Today, Sheen talks about that role and others. He played journalist David Frost confronting Richard Nixon about Watergate in Frost-Nixon, and he played Prime Minister Tony Blair in The Queen and two other films. When Sheen met Blair in real life,
I could see that he sort of wants to be lovely and nice to me, but also doesn't want to give anything away just in case I use it. And it was like two dogs sniffing each other.
Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the Complete Chick Webb and Ella Fitzgerald Decca sessions, and Maureen Corrigan delivers her list of the year's best books. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross.
Why would a woman fake an orgasm?
Usually so the woman could get back to whatever it is she'd rather be doing.
My guest, British actor Michael Sheen, is currently starring in the Showtime series Masters of Sex, in which he plays the groundbreaking sex researcher William Masters. Some of Sheen's most memorable roles have been playing real people. He was a highly regarded theater actor in England, where he played Mozart and Caligula, among others. He got into movies and earned good reviews, playing Prime Minister Tony Blair in The Queen and two other films. And he played the late British journalist David Frost in the stage and screen versions of Frost Nixon. Sheen's also had his share of fictional roles, including a funny guest appearance on several episodes of the TV series 30 Rock. When I spoke to Michael Sheen, we began with the new Showtime series Masters of Sex, about the collaboration between Dr. William Masters and his associate Virginia Johnson. Starting in the 1950s, they researched the physiological impact of sex by observing men and women having intercourse with electrodes attached to capture physical changes. In this scene, Masters and Johnson have decided to participate in the study by having sex with each other. And beforehand, they're asking each other the background questions every participant has to answer. Johnson, played by Lizzie Kaplan, speaks first.
I was 15.
Where did it take place?
In the back of a Plymouth. And how old were you when you first had sexual intercourse?
20. In a cabin on Rainbow Lake.
Did you have sexual intercourse with your spouse before marriage?
I did not. Did you?
Yes, with both marriages.
I suppose it never occurred to me to wait until marriage.
If currently married, how frequently do you have coitus with your spouse?
We're not having coitus presently.
Because of the miscarriage, I should have skipped that question.
That's all right. How frequently do you have coitus with a partner?
I don't have a partner at present.
Meaning you're not having coitus?
Meaning no, not right now. Last question before we start. Does emotional attachment play a significant role in your ability to enjoy sex?
Significant role? Hard to say, but yes, I suppose so. A qualified yes. And you?
Not really. I mean, it can, but it's a curious thing. I've always felt different from other women. Most women, they want love when they sleep with a man, but I've always been able to separate sex from love.
And that's our guest, Michael Sheen, and Lizzie Kaplan in the Showtime series Masters of Sex. Well, Michael Sheen, welcome to Fresh Air. So much is going on there as we listen to your voice. I mean, this guy is detached. He's threatened. He's trying to be honest. It's also kind of the kind of conversation people have before they're about to become physically intimate, which is, you know, kind of fraught with tension anyway.
Yes, exactly. I mean, incredibly vulnerable and exposing and intimate. And that's a big part of what the show is about. You know, I think the thing that makes people's ears prick up is that it's a show about sex and a study about sex. But it's, you know, ultimately it's a study of intimacy, of how do we deal with being vulnerable with each other? How do we deal with the challenges of intimacy and the kind of games we play and the defenses we have? And you can sort of hear it in that, couching, you know, phrases around very technical terms or scientific terms, when in fact what's actually going on is something much more naked and raw and vulnerable.
Yeah. Well, I guess what I find fascinating when I remember these scenes where you and Lizzie Kaplan are looking at each other and you're supposed to be these two professionals engaging in an act of research, but in fact you're engaging in this very intimate act of physical intercourse. And there are moments where you're looking into each other's eyes, and I see this, like, am I going to express love here? I start to, and then I catch myself because, no, I can't be doing that. This is all about science.
Yeah, well, yes. I mean, specifically scenes where, for instance, like you're describing, where we are having sex, but because the whole idea is that it's separate of emotion and attraction and all those kind of things, that it's just scientific. You know, of course it can't be. It's impossible for it to be like that. But you have these two people, or certainly this one person, Bill Masters, who is, you know, leading the experiment and trying not to show any emotion. And that is a very peculiar thing to play as an actor, to be doing something that is usually in a story the most intimate thing, where you're, you know, where it becomes very, you know, you see desire, you see lust, you see attraction, you see all those things, you're kissing or whatever, and that sort of makes it easy. You lose yourself in it. And here's a scene where we're not even supposed to look at each other particularly as it's happening, and I'm supposed to say orgasm as I orgasm, or plateau, or whatever it might be. And that is a very peculiar thing to act, but it's sort of brilliant, you know, it's a wonderful thing to act. It's great to be able to do it like that, rather than the sort of usual boring way. Regular sex will always be just boring for me now.
How well does the story of William Masters and Virginia Johnson, as we see it in the series, do you know how closely that conforms to, you know, their actual lives and experiences? Mm. How much artistic license there is?
Well, Michelle Ashford, who created the series, based it on the book by Thomas Mayer about Bill and Virginia. Mm-hmm. And so what's useful in a way is that you've got this kind of template, this you know, the actual events of their life, the facts of their life, that we constantly, you know, draw on. That's absolutely the spine of what we're doing. But at the same time, they as a relationship, and Bill Masters specifically as a man, it was very difficult to know what was going on. They were very secretive and private, and he was very, you know, he was very defended and guarded, and it was very difficult to get to know him for real. So even though you can look at the facts of their life and you can see, oh, this happened and that happened and that happened, that's so not the full story, which is great for us, you know, because then you can, you by necessity, you have to explore, you have to invent within that framework. So I think it's a kind of perfect combination of actual factual accuracy and invention.
We're speaking with Michael Sheen. He stars in the new Showtime series, Masters of Sex. I'd like to talk about The Queen, the 2006 film that you were in, with directed by Stephen Frears, in which you played Prime Minister Tony Blair. And this is one of three films in which you've played Tony Blair. This is the middle of the three. I guess there's a particular challenge to playing a real person who's still around and whom the audience has very clear images of.
Yes. I mean, it's a lot of it, apart from anything else, is about expectations, I suppose, and people's own, certainly in Britain particularly, people's own personal feelings about that person, when it's a politician and a prime minister, and by the point that we were making the films, really a very controversial political figure, then how people feel about him personally clearly plays into how they're going to react to what you're doing in the film. So that's, you know, a huge challenge.
Well, let's hear a clip from the film. This is, you know, it's about Queen Elizabeth and the royal family's reaction to the untimely death of Princess Diana when Tony Blair was, I guess, relatively recently elected prime minister. And the problem was the Queen was very remote and appeared to be uncaring to a grieving public, since Princess Diana was no longer a part of the royal family. And the result was horrifically negative media coverage, popular anger at the Queen and even at the monarchy itself. And Prime Minister Blair, you know, spends a lot of the film trying to advise the Queen to come to London, make a public statement, show some sympathy, which eventually she does, and that gesture is well received. And the scene we're going to hear is near the end of the film, months after that drama, when the Prime Minister has his regular meeting with the Queen. She's played by Helen Mirren. And in this meeting, you refer back to that tumultuous week that you experienced.
The circumstances were exceptional, ma'am. And in the end, you showed great personal strength, courage, and humility.
You're confusing humility with humiliation.
That's not true.
You didn't read the cards on the flowers outside the palace that Friday.
I actually think history will show it was a good week for you.
And an even better one for you, Mr. Blair.
But there are 52 weeks in the year, ma'am, and 2,500 in the time since you've been queen. And when people come to assess your legacy, they won't remember those few days.
Oh, really? You don't think that what affection people once had for this institution has been diminished?
No, not at all. You're more respected now than ever.
I gather some of your closest advisers were less fulsome in their support.
One or two. But as a leader, I could never have added my voice to that chorus.
Because you saw those headlines and you thought one day that might happen to me. And it will, Mr. Blair. Quite suddenly and without warning.
And that is Helen Mirren as Queen Elizabeth, and our guest Michael Sheen in the film The Queen. And we should mention the other two times that you played Tony Blair was for the film The Deal, which was about his conversation with Gordon Brown, and then the one after The Queen was that special relationship, an HBO film about his relationship with, I guess, Bill Clinton and to some extent George W. Bush.
Yes.
When you made The Queen in 2006, you had played a lot of leading roles, and here you're playing the most powerful man in Britain, I suppose. But his role in this drama is to sort of react to the Queen and maybe kind of express the country's reaction to the Queen. And I wondered if it was hard to take on a role of this powerful man essentially supporting, you know, Helen Mirren's performance as Her Majesty.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because the role is, I think, in a lot of Peter Morgan's films. Peter Morgan is the writer of The Queen. He also wrote The Deal and Special Relationship. He also wrote Frost Nixon. He also wrote The Damned United. So we've done a lot of projects together, and one of the things that is the case sort of repeatedly in a lot of his work is that there are often two characters pitted against each other, or certainly, you know, working with each other. And one of them I always think of as being the kind of mythological hero going into the maze, you know, like Perseus or Odysseus or something. And the other character is the monster, is the thing at the heart of the labyrinth. And we follow the story of the hero, of course. We, you know, that's, as an audience, that's our point of contact and that's the main thrust of the story. But we're fascinated and compelled and drawn to the monster, who we know less about, who is more enigmatic, who is more hidden. But often the monster part is the supporting part, and it's the hero who is the hero, literally. But our fascination with the monster is such that that's the character who looms largest in our consciousness, you know, or in our unconsciousness, I suppose. So, for instance, in Frost Nixon, it's Frost who is the character that we follow. It's his story that we're following. But it's Nixon who's the Minotaur at the heart of the labyrinth, and the same with the Queen. And that's, you know, for a figure who, I think this is one of the things that Peter Morgan does brilliantly, is that taking figures who we're so familiar with and yet not, you know, figures who have become almost two-dimensional in our minds and have become huge in that sense, in that Nixon had become a sort of a cardboard cutout figure, a sort of bogeyman, and the Queen had become a sort of iconic but very, you know, surface kind of understanding for us, and then fleshing them out, making them three-dimensional.
Well, I want to talk about Frost Nixon in a moment, but, you know, since you played Tony Blair so much and so well, did you ever talk to him about your performances?
I tend to, on the rare occasions when I played characters who are actually still alive, and there is the possibility, I suppose, of meeting them, I have always shied away from that. Certainly until a point where I feel confident in where I'm going with the character, or what my take is, at least, because I don't want to be thrown off. I don't want to feel compromised in how I approach the characters. And if you actually know the person, then that can be a bit difficult. With Blair, in between The Queen and Special Relationship, where I felt like I sort of knew what I was doing a bit more, there was the opportunity came up to meet him, and so I did, and it was very interesting. I knew that he had said that he'd never watched any of the films, which I think, from a political point of view, was the most appropriate response, because if he says he's seen them, then obviously people can say, well, is that true, and did that happen, and did that happen, and, you know, I'm sure he doesn't want to get into those sort of conversations. So he certainly possessed a very good working knowledge of scenes from all three, or all two at that point. And in fact, when I was doing the research, it was very interesting over the course of the three that as I did research in between for each one and preparation for each one, I would obviously look at any new footage that had come out since the last one. And in doing the preparation for Special Relationship, the third one, of course, in the documentaries, which there had been a lot made because Blair had, you know, was no longer Prime Minister, And so there was a lot of, you know, his legacy and his the overall thing. Obviously, the films like The Deal and The Queen became part of those documentaries. So my research included my own performance, which was very peculiar.
But so when you met, there was no pat on the shoulder, no attaboy, no, you didn't get this quite right, none of that.
Oh, goodness me, no, there was certainly no attaboy. It was a very kind of, it was like two dogs sniffing each other a little bit. He was very qualified in his kind of reaction. He's someone who clearly is very charming and is very easy to like and warm to when you meet them as a human being. But I could see that his sort of senses were kind of going haywire, where he sort of wants to be lovely and nice to me, but also doesn't want to give anything away just in case I use it and all that kind of stuff. So it was very strange. And then essentially he put his chief of staff and the lady who ran his foundation on me, and they kept me away from him all night.
We're speaking with Michael Sheen. He stars in the new Showtime series, Masters of Sex. We'll continue our conversation after a quick break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with actor Michael Sheen. He stars with Lizzie Kaplan in the new Showtime series, Masters of Sex. I want to talk about Frost Nixon, the film that you made in 2008, also written by Peter Morgan. It's directed by Ron Howard. And I should explain a little bit, because I'm sure we have some listeners who are a little too young to remember this. I mean, President Nixon had resigned in 1974 after the Watergate scandal and was living in isolation in California. And this flashy English journalist and celebrity interviewer, David Frost, pulled off this deal, paying Nixon for a series of interviews that got a huge audience. And there was a play and film, which you starred in, about the whole project, the preparation, and how Frost pulls it off. And I wanted to play a clip from the film. And this is in the last of the interviews, when David Frost finally gets down to boring into Nixon about the Watergate scandal. And we're going to hear you as David Frost speaking with Nixon, who's played by Frank Langella. They're talking about the details of the cover-up of the Watergate break-in. Let's listen.
Now, you've always maintained that you knew nothing about any of this until March 21st. Right. But in February, your personal lawyer came to Washington to start the raising of $219,000 of hush money to be paid to the burglars. Now, do you seriously expect us to believe that you had no knowledge of that?
None. I believe the money was for humanitarian purposes, to help disadvantaged people with their defenses.
Well, it was being delivered on the tops of phone booths with aliases, and at airports by people with gloves on. That's not normally the way lawyers' fees are delivered.
Look, I have made statements to this effect before. All that was Haldeman and Ehrlichman's business. I knew nothing. Okay, fine. Fine. You made a conclusion there. I stated my view. Now let's move on. Let's get
no,
on with
hold
the rest
on.
Of
no, hold on.
No, I don't
no,
want
hold
to
on.
Continue
Haldeman
this.
And
in a crackling confrontation there in the film Frost Nixon, that was our guest, Michael Sheen, and Frank Langella playing Nixon. Boy, it's fun to watch you play David Frost, kind of these special verbal tics. And I mean, he's flashy. He's, you know, he's outspoken. Tell us a little about how you got David Frost. I heard you followed him once walking down the street.
Yeah, I was when we were rehearsing for the play. I was invited to a party fairly early on in the rehearsals or something, and I went to it. And just as I was about to walk in, I was crossing the road, and I saw David Frost with someone walking down the street. And I just thought, this is clearly too serendipitous to ignore. And so I kind of just followed him for a bit, just sort of getting a sense of who he is, you know, in the flesh as a physical creature, just how he moves and that kind of stuff. And that was my first physical experience of him. But he, you know, it's interesting because he is someone who was so, so very familiar to a British audience. The problem you have when you're playing someone who is so familiar to an audience is that the first thing their expectation brings is, oh, is he going to look like him? Is he going to sound like him? You know, that kind of thing. And so you do have to meet that. You can't ignore that, because ignoring it could be as detrimental as overly playing to that. The point is to try and take that out of the equation as soon as possible so that the audience can just focus on what's going on underneath. Because otherwise, people might think it's a brilliant impersonation, but they're not following the story.
And Frost is a guy who has a showman's, you know, kind of confidence, but there's an edge to him, too, in the film. He's unsettled, isn't he?
Well, again, the engine of that character for me was the combination of on the surface, he seemed like his reputation was of being this sort of playboy. He had this kind of glamorous life, and that he was quite superficial. That was one of the ways that people saw him, and that he was very much a sort of people pleaser. He wanted people to like him. He was charming. He seemed very laid back, but underneath, he was a very driven, very ambitious, very hardworking man. In some ways, you could say ruthless as well. It's the interplay of those two sides of him that are so interesting to explore.
Michael Sheen stars in the Showtime series Masters of Sex. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Wix.com, enabling over 30 million local businesses to create customized websites with the Wix website builder at Wix.com. From Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and Progressive.com. And from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, offering genomic testing that may reveal other treatment options for individual cancer patients at cancercenter.com. This is NPR.
Rhythm and romance, romance and rhythm.
Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews the complete Chick Webb and Ella Fitzgerald Decca sessions. She got her start with the band at the tender age of 16. Also, Maureen Corrigan picks her best books of the year. And more with actor Michael Sheen, who talks about revisiting his early obsession, soccer, in the film The Damned United. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, in for Terry Gross. We're speaking with British actor Michael Sheen. He's currently starring in the Showtime series Masters of Sex, about groundbreaking sex researchers William Masters and Virginia Johnson. Among his other films are The Queen, in which he played Prime Minister Tony Blair, and Frost Nixon, in which he plays journalist David Frost confronting Richard Nixon about Watergate. Well, I wanted to talk about the film The Damned United, a 2009 film directed by Tom Hooper. I just love this film, and I want to bring it up in partly so more American audiences will find it. It's about a British soccer figure. Explain to us who your character Brian Clough was. He's a real guy.
Mm. Well, in similar to David Frost in a way, they were contemporaries. When I was growing up, Brian Clough was one of the biggest larger-than-life characters in the whole of British culture. He was a soccer manager, or coach, I think people would refer to him as over here. He, a number of times, worked with teams that were languishing at the bottom of the very minor divisions, and through sheer force of personality on the whole, would lead them into becoming championship-winning teams. And he had such an extraordinary personality and was so unpredictable and so controversial and did such extraordinary things and had such massive contradictions within his character that he exerted this kind of influence over a group of men. And the problem within our story comes when the other soccer coach, who's the biggest soccer coach in Britain at the time with the most successful team, a man called Don Revy, leading a team called Leeds United, Clough has said such awful things about him and awful things about his team, who are the main team. And then Clough gets offered the job of being the manager of that team after Don Revy leaves.
Well, let me break in right there, because that's the clip that we have where you have just taken the job, you as Brian Clough, as the manager of Leeds United, having proved yourself a remarkable manager, a coach elsewhere, and now you're taking over this group of stars who've had championships in their past. And let's listen to your first discussion with the players.
You lot may all be internationals and have won all the domestic honours there are to win under Don Revy. But as far as I'm concerned, the first thing you can do for me is to chuck all your medals and all your caps and all your pots and all your pans into the biggest dustbin you can find, because you've never won any of them fairly. You've done it all by bloody cheating. Mr. William Bremner, you're the captain, and a good one. But you're no good to the team, and you're no good to me if you're suspended. I want you fit for every game, and I want good, clean, attractive football from my captain, starting next week at the Charity Shield. And you, Irishman, God gave you skill, intelligence, and the best passing ability in the game. What God did not give you was six studs to wrap around another player's knee. Now, things are going to be a little different around here without Don. Might feel a little strange at first, might pinch a little like a new pair of shoes. But if you want your grandchildren to remember you as being something other than the dirty buggers you once were, if you want to be loved as real champions, worthy champions, you're going to have to work and improve and change.
Hello, coach. I just love that scene. That is our guest, Michael Sheen, in the film The Damned United. You know, I know from reading about you that you were quite the soccer player as a young man. In fact, at age 12, you had a shot at going to a professional team, and your dad said, no, we're not going to move to London, so you can do that. And you went into acting, obviously had great success at it. But you clearly were an athlete when you were younger, and there is a moment in this film, near this one, where you're standing in front of the new players at Leeds, and you do a little soccer stuff. Will you tell us about filming that and the moves that you put on?
Yeah, well, it's true. I was that was my obsession, was soccer when I was growing up. So I did a lot of it, and then of course when I started to get a modicum of success as an actor, everyone would always ask about it. And I suppose in some ways made the mistake of saying that I was offered a place at a professional team, and so this became part of, you know, the publicity about me. So then when I actually came to do a film about a soccer player, of course everyone was just waiting to watch whether I could actually do it or not. And so the day that we did that scene that we heard the clip from, after he does that speech and he's just, you know, made these men just so angry at him, and he's so cocky and he's so full of himself, and at the end of it he just he gets one of the players to kick the ball over to him, and he sort of does keepy up, where you sort of keep volleying it and keeping it up on your head and your knee and your shoulders and all that kind of stuff, and then turns around and then kicks it and hits it into the top of the net. That's in the script. So the day we shot that film, the pressure was enormous. I couldn't believe it. I thought, this is where it's all going to come tumbling down and people are going to go, you're a liar, you were never any good. First take, back of the net. Oh, yes. And it's there as evidence on those film cameras.
I know that you grew up in Wales, a town called Port Talbot. Tell us a bit about growing up in Port Talbot. It was a coastal city in Wales. Tell us about, I don't know, what your parents did, what kind of childhood you had.
Well, it's not a city. It's a town. It has sort of between, I guess, about 35, 40,000 people. It's on the coast, yes. It's an old steel town, sort of built up around a steelworks, And there was also a chemical plant there for a long time growing up. So the town itself is known in the area, really, for being sort of a joke. It was the dirty, sort of industrial, smelly place in amongst quite beautiful rural areas on either side. So growing up in the town, it was a town that had very low self-esteem. There was high unemployment. Once the people started getting laid off at the steelworks, the chemical plant closed down. It's a working-class town. It was quite rough. I grew up in a sort of atmosphere of latent violence most of the time. But it was a place that, you know, my family had grown up in and come from for generations. And I sort of, I don't know, it sort of instilled a passionate love of this place. And partly an aesthetic as well. I found out years and years later that a hero of mine, Terry Gilliam, got the idea for the film Brazil from actually being on the beach in Port Talbot. He told me that he was scouting for another film that he did, Time Bandits, which he shot some of in Wales. But when he was scouting for it and he went down onto the beach, he was sitting there on the beach in a deck chair with a steelworks on one side with flames coming out and huge, monstrous kind of metal cylinders and things. And then on the other side of him, this chemical plant with orange smoke belching out of cooling towers, and he said in his head he just heard dun 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 dun, and that was when he got the idea for Brazil.
Wow.
So you get a sense of what the place looks like from that, really.
And you know, your parents were not in show business, obviously, but did you have a grandmother who was a lion tamer? Did I read this?
Yes, well, this was the family folklore, and you know, I think there's all kinds of myths that grow up within families, aren't there?
Well, mention,
never quite sure.
Mention that, and then your dad's work.
I ended up doing one of those programs where they do your genealogy, you know, and look into your family history, and it turned out that it was actually true. My great-great-great-grandmother was an elephant and lion tamer, and whose left breast was mauled off by one of the lions, and the claw from that lion is around a chain in my house as we speak, supposedly. And then it takes a while before you find anything anywhere near as outlandish as that in the family. But then my father, who had had various sort of normal jobs for most of his life, at a certain point became a Jack Nicholson lookalike and spent his happiest working years going all over the world being a Jack Nicholson lookalike.
And he does the voice and everything?
He has a go. I won't say... Well, what I usually say is that what he lacks in specificity, he makes up for in commitment.
Okay. I have to ask you about one other thing. An appearance you made in several episodes of the NBC comedy 30 Rock, where you play this character. Is it Wesley Snipes? Do I have the right name?
Yeah. It is the one and only Wesley Snipes.
And he and Liz Lemon, who's played by Tina Fey, have this reason to believe that they might be meant for one another. So they get together a few times, and it really goes badly, and they don't particularly like each other, but they keep running into each other. And in the scene we're about to hear, there's this another bizarre chance encounter where she's standing on a sidewalk, and you... as Wesley Snipes are on a bicycle about to, and you crash into a taxi, and then a conversation ensues. Let's listen.
Gangway for foot cycle! Come on! I said gangway for the... You witch!
No, I am walking away.
Wait, Liz, wait. Look, I wasn't even supposed to ride my foot cycle home today.
Stop calling it that.
Yeah, fine, my velocipede, but I did ride it. Because the universe wanted me to run into you again. And I finally think I know why.
Commencing eye roll sequence.
The universe wants us to settle for one another. Well, there has to be a reason this keeps happening to us, Liz. I think fate is telling us this is the best we're ever going to get. We're each other's settling soulmates.
Settling soulmates? That is grim. And I've played Monopoly alone.
Well, I know it's not ideal, but we'd both benefit. I mean, I could open jars and kill bugs for you, and you could make me look less gay at work functions.
And that's our guest Michael Sheen and Tina Fey on 30 Rock. You want to just tell us a little bit about what it was like to be in this American comedy working with Tina Fey and that crew?
Well, it's extraordinary. It's happened to me a couple of times where I've been a huge fan of something and then get the opportunity to actually be in it. It happened with a show in Britain as well called The League of Gentlemen, which I was a huge fan of. And so, again, similar with 30 Rock, I was such a huge fan of it. I loved the show. And then suddenly found myself in it, talking to Liz Lemon and talking to these characters, which is a very peculiar experience. Also quite intimidating because, you know, talk about ensembles, they're a crack ensemble, you know, and so smart and so in the groove of what they're doing. So to walk into that was a little intimidating. But what was great is that Tina starts to kind of write for you as you start working with her, which was a little disturbing as my character got more and more bizarre and weird and outlandish the more she actually knew me. But it was just such great fun and so wonderful to do.
Michael Sheen, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Michael Sheen stars in the Showtime series Masters of Sex. The final episode airs Sunday night at 10. Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews some early recordings of Ella Fitzgerald with the Chick Webb Band. This is Fresh Air. In 1935, drummer Chick Webb was a Harlan bandleader looking to make a bigger impact on recordings, and singer Ella Fitzgerald was a homeless teenager who'd recently won an Apollo Theater talent contest. They were introduced, and she joined his band. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead tells us about a new box set that showcases their work together.
Chick Webb taking a too rare drum feature with his big band on Gershwin's Liza. Webb's outfit terrorized competitors in band battles and sent dancers into orbit at Harlem's Savoy Ballroom. On record, they were rarely that explosive. Early on, they did have some hot Edgar Sampson arrangements that Benny Goodman would soon turn into hits, like Blue Lou and Don't Be That Way. But the Webb band also had an old-school crooner, Charles Linton, with pre-jazz age enunciation.
I drew a curtain around us, and the blossom with a duo with a gleam. Romance and happiness found us, and carried us off in a dream. Oh, moonlight.
Charles Linton helped draw a curtain over Mannard's singing like his when he brought scruffy 16-year-old Ella Fitzgerald to Chick Webb's attention. Her sound was streamlined and modern, about melody and rhythm more than emoting. Ella was unformed, but could read music and learn a song in a second. "This is it," Webb said. "I have a real singer now. That's what the public wants." Music publishers deluged the band with mostly forgettable mid-tempo swing tunes, but Ella could make something out of almost anything. Her articulation was always precise, but as in later years, a New York accent might slip out.
Oh, baby, I don't want any bright and yellow. You can have your sweet romance. Sing me a swing song and let me dance. Mr. Trombone, play some corn. I ain't caring what notes. Mr. Trumpet, grab a horn. Brother, give me hot notes. Oh, baby, I don't want any on a cello. Give the rhythm and a chance. Sing me a swing song and let me dance.
Contrary to press reports, Chick Webb never adopted Ella Fitzgerald, but there was some family feeling in the band, the belief that the success of one was good for all. Benny Goodman made some moves to steal her away, but Ella stayed put. She started writing a bit and had a hand in her mega hit, A Tisket a Tasket, one of the band's several adapted children's songs. The first song Fitzgerald co-wrote, You Showed Me the Way, could almost have been a love letter to Webb and the orchestra that gave her a home.
You showed me the way when I was someone in distress. a heart in search of happiness. You showed me the way. My skies were so gray. I never knew I'd feel a thrill. I couldn't dream a dream until you showed me the way.
Meanwhile, the band's soloists still got a few chances to strut on record. Chick Webb, like other leaders, had a little band drawn from the big one, his Little Chicks, with its intertwined clarinet and flute. Wayman Carver takes a rare for 1937 flute solo on Sweet Sue. Webb swings at a whisper using wire brushes. Chick Webb suffered from tuberculosis of the spine and other ailments and died in a Baltimore hospital in 1939. His ultra-cool last words, "I'm sorry, but I gotta go." The orchestra continued under Ella's name, losing steam even as she matured. The last of their juvenile tunes, 1941's Melindy the Mouse, had a grown-up subtext. You can hear how Ella Fitzgerald's light touch showed the way to flip new band singers like Anita O'Day.
Melinda was a mousie living in a little housey, and her life was one of wonderful ease. On the sunny side of 20, with a papa who had plenty, her life was just a bowl of cheese. One day a kitty said, "My, but you're pretty, I love you." Mousie near died, but replied, "Why, I know nothing of you. You're just a kitty cat." But kitty,
this music's from a typically mammoth, lovingly annotated 8-CD box from Mosaic, the complete Chick Webb and Ella Fitzgerald Decca Sessions, 1934 to 1941. It actually warms up with a few earlier tracks. Various budget anthologies skim the vocal or instrumental cream from these four dozen sessions. The complete output shows how hits collections distort the historical record. When the old days look rosier to us, we're usually remembering the highlight reel. There are hidden gems here, but they ain't all gems. By 1941, Ella had ripened enough to go solo, and the orchestra folded. Before long, singers like Frank Sinatra were eclipsing big bands as popular attractions. Chick Webb and Ella Fitzgerald had already showed them the way.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Point of Departure, Downbeat, and E-Music, and is the author of Why Jazz. He reviewed the complete Chick Webb and Ella Fitzgerald Decca Sessions, 1934 through 1941, on the Mosaic label. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan shares her picks for the best books of 2013. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. book critic Maureen Corrigan's Best Books of the Year list takes readers from Calcutta to Las Vegas, from colonial Boston to America's futuristic suburbs. Here's her top, well, 11.
First, a word about this list. It's honestly just a fluke that my best books rundown for 2013 is so gender biased. I didn't deliberately set out this year to read so many terrific books by women. Let's start with Alice McDermott. Without ever hamming up the humility, Alice McDermott's latest novel, Someone, tells the life story of an ordinary woman named Marie, who comes of age in mid-20th century Brooklyn and works for a time in a funeral parlor. McDermott reveals to readers what's distinct about people like Marie, who don't have the ego or eloquence to make a case for themselves as being anything special. Unlike McDermott's submissive Marie, the main character of The Woman Upstairs, Claire Massoud's latest novel, is like a dormant volcano getting ready to blow. Nora Eldridge is a single elementary school teacher in her 30s who's grimly disciplined herself to settling for less. When a glamorous family enters her life and reignites her artistic and erotic energies, Nora, like Jane Eyre, gets in touch with her anger and her hunger. Jhumpa Lahiri's The Lowland is another stark novel that charts the fate of two brothers in Calcutta in the 1960s, one a political activist, the other a stick-in-the-mud academic. The Lowland is an ambitious story about the rashness of youth, as well as the hesitation and regret that can make a long life not worth living. Ambition is what makes Donna Tartt's The Goldfinch my novel of the year. Jumbo-sized, coincidence-laced, it's Dickensian in its cast of characters and range of emotions. In fact, there's a lot of David Copperfield in the main character, Theo Decker, who's 13 when the sudden death of his mother propels him on a cross-country odyssey that includes a season in hell in Las Vegas and brushes with the Russian mob. Always yearning for his lost mother, Theo is like the goldfinch in the 17th century Dutch painting that gives this extraordinary novel its name. An alert yellow bird chained to a perch by its twig of an ankle. My debut novel of the year is Adele Waldman's brilliant comedy of manners and ideas, The Love Affairs of Nathaniel P. Waldman thoroughly inhabits the head of a sensitive cad named Nate Piven, a writer living in Brooklyn. There are many throwaway moments of hilarity here, such as when Nate endures his weekly telephone chat with his father, who asks him the question every aspiring writer is asked nowadays. Have you given any thought to self-publishing? A boy-girl pair ties for my best short story collection nod. Karen Russell's Vampires in the Lemon Grove contains some genuine creepers, like Proving Up, a tale of the American frontier that reads like a collaboration between Willa Cather and Emily Dickinson. The standout in George Saunders' collection, The 10th of December, is The Semplica Girl Diaries, a story whose power could single-handedly change immigration policy. In biography, the winner for me this year was Jill Lepore's Book of Ages about Jane Franklin, Ben's little sister. To excavate the remains of Jane's hidden story, Lepore augments her own training as a historian with literary criticism, sociology, archaeology, and even some of the techniques of fiction. Patricia Volk's boisterous memoir, Shocked, also breaks traditional genre rules. Shocked explores the two titanic women who impress their ideas of beauty and femaleness on Volk. Her mother, Audrey, a famous beauty, and the designer Elsa Schiaparelli. In her writing and in her memoir's gorgeous illustrations, Volk has embraced something of Schiaparelli's surrealist approach to art. Roger Rosenblatt's evocative memoir, The Boy Detective, also challenges easy categorization. His book combines a walking tour around vanished Manhattan with a meditation, not only on the classic mystery fiction he loves, but also on those larger metaphysical mysteries that defy even the shrewdest detective's reasoning. Speaking at last of mysteries, my best mystery of the year turns out to be yet another stunner from Scandinavia. The Dinosaur Feather is a debut novel by a Dane named S.J. Gazan, who takes us deep into the insular world of scientists investigating dinosaur evolution. I could be wrong, but I don't think I am, when I say that Gazan disposes of a murder victim here by an infernal means that no other mystery writer, not even the resourceful Dame Agatha, ever concocted. And yes, in case you're wondering, S.J. Gazan is a woman. Everybody knows the female of the species is deadlier than the male. Happy reading to one and all.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. You can find her 10 best list at freshair.npr.org. You can also visit NPR's brand new book concierge, where you can find Maureen's reviews and many more at npr.org/bestbooks. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our assistant producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Little Pym, a children's language learning program that teaches French, Spanish, Mandarin, and more. Online at littlepim.com. From the Annie E. Casey Foundation, developing solutions to support strong families and communities for America's children at aecf.org. And from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. This is NPR.
All is lost here. Except for soul and body.
Robert Redford has a solo performance in the new film about a man lost at sea. On the next Fresh Air, Redford talks about that role, growing up, getting kicked out of college, starring in early episodic TV, and the film that made him famous, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Join us.